question and answer session. Before we get underway with that, I'd like to thank all the folks from Network 2 and Network 5 who have supported us. Tip and Jack and I would not be able to do this without the support that they provided, and I think the networks and the Fistula First program generally have done a terrific job getting everything together for us here and have made this program a great success. I think they all deserve a round of applause. I forgot to mention it. I think I mentioned it before, but when you fill out your CME forms, the maximum number of hours here is 8 hours and 15 minutes, or 8 1/4 hours. Now, you have to subtract the time you're outside having a cookie.
Great discussion about steel. If I understood you correctly, the indication for early ligation, without question, is the severe ischemic neuropathy. Is that correct?
Exactly.
What about the patient, however, who presents with what you feel to be a steel syndrome, arterial insufficiency, the hand is ice cold, terrible pain, and you're thinking to yourself, I don't have time to think about this. I don't have time to come up with alternate solutions. Ligation is the only option. In other words, it may be neuropathic, but at the same time, it seems to be an arterial problem.
I think there are a significant number of cases where you don't know, and you don't want to take a chance. In the ischemic neuropathy syndromes, even if you ligate that fistula, those patients will often have an ongoing problem with that hand. It will never function again. And that's what distinguishes. It's not if you correct the ischemia, the problem's better. They're really not ischemic to begin with. It's a transient injury that seems to set off something that was already kind of quiescent in the patient before you intervened. What I like to do in these patients is be safe, and that is go to the operating room. I do the arteriogram there. Again, that's my practice as a vascular surgeon. I have the ability to do that. I've got the facilities to do it, and if I don't see a treatable arterial lesion, I'll ligate the fistula. I don't fool around with these. I don't know. I'd be interested in your views, Tip.
Just a couple of comments on. I thought that was a great steel talk. Something we want to never see. This idiopathic monomyelic neuropathy is a rare bird. It's almost. I don't know that it's recorded with access other than brachial artery. So if you are able to hang on to distal or proximal radial artery, you're not going to see it, essentially. I also have thought of it and viewed it as a flash neuropathy that occurs in these rare it's almost essentially always in diabetics, that happens when you put the clamps on the brachial artery. So you interrupt flow down the hand. They have a flash neuropathy that ends up being this disabling thing. Those patients present with a hot hand, with a warm hand, with a bounding pulse. They're not the ones with a cold, white hand. All that being said, and those people all need to have their fistula ligated immediately if you think that's what they have. All that being said, if you feel yourself threatened with extremity loss, I wouldn't take a deep breath. I'd go ligate the fistula.
Sir?
Yep, Rick Mishler, Phoenix. Just a comment going back a little bit to the secondary fistula discussion. I'm trying to remember the decision-making, but in Beathard's article, I think they excluded upper arm grafts for a secondary fistula. And my point would be, I'm not sure that's appropriate, but what we have observed is long-functioning grafts, even upper arm, will often somehow, either the veins were missed initially, mm-hmm. or they've somehow gotten some flow over the time, and they're now of a reasonable quality. We see this by duplex scanning, and that's my point, I would be very quick to duplex scan anybody that's got a failing graft and assume nothing, because they may have been missed from the get-go.
Yeah, I probably didn't make that completely clear in my presentation, and that sort of is the next step beyond looking at the upper arm exclusively, but scanning all of these patients. And you're absolutely right. Many times the initial surgeon may not have considered a fistula, even though there was a good conduit. And certainly powering up the arm in one place or another will often cause that vein to enlarge and become a much more suitable conduit. So when you've got a failing graft or a graft that's had repeated issues, a comprehensive survey looking for new veins is a great idea.
Just one more caveat. That's one of the concerns I have about the push to get some of these problems solved with an initial hospitalization mm-hmm. with an ESRD patient, that may not be the best place to find the best veins because they may have been killed or injured in the ER when the patient came in. And I'm not saying don't do that, but that's my concern about a hospital setting, that we do miss opportunities for fistulas and maybe they end up with a graft, but maybe that's okay. They get a secondary fistula in 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Carlton Young, UAB. Thank you very much for being here. Two questions. One, for the pediatric patient, to go back to them. Given that we have criteria for the size of the vein in the artery for adults, given that children are little human beings, what criteria do you use for them, whether or not to proceed or not? Secondly, how is it that you go about creating these low-flow fistulas? Technically, what size arteriotomy do you use and so forth to make sure it's a low-flow that does not subsequently become a high flow, especially when you have these proximal stenoses that you brought up?
Those are two separate questions,
oh, yeah.
And I'll address them separately.
Oh, yeah.
One is, I've referred several times, and that's a fair question, to a low-flow fistula. And what I'm referring to there, generically, a non-brachial or a radial artery fistula, whether it's a basilic vein or a brachial vein transposition, if you come off the proximal radial artery, it's not going to be a 1,500 flow fistula. And so that's what I mean when I say low flow. If you're coming off a 2.5 millimeter radial artery, proximal or distal, then you're going to have a 500 flow fistula. And I think patients' hearts and their circulation, everything is better with a moderate or low flow fistula.
That's
so that's what I meant generically by
okay.
that. Now, the first part of your mm-hmm. question was about pediatric surgery, mm-hmm. and there's not a lot of those. We do deal with smaller vessels, mm-hmm. and since you don't have the issue of arterial inflow problems, at least I don't see arterial sclerotic disease mm-hmm. in these little kids, I'm willing to use a millimeter and a half artery, and I'm willing to use a 2 millimeter vein,
okay.
and I can almost always find a way mm-hmm. to come up with some plan like that. My experience is their veins, their arteries are super compliant, mm-hmm. and they respond promptly.
Mm-hmm. Do you try to make the arteriotomy longer, a centimeter,
well,
centimeter and a
half? Well, I try to use the radial artery.
Right.
I try to use the radial artery so mm-hmm. I'm not concerned about
okay.
the length of my anastomosis.
Okay.
If I use the brachial artery, then I become
yes.
nervous.
Okay.
And you can chop that up in two different ways. If you could say, well, if I'm going to use, in a little kid, I'm going to use do a brachial artery anastomosis, then maybe I better interrupt the sutures so that the fistula can, quote, grow with the kid as he gets bigger.
Mm.
That goes both ways. Maybe the fistula will grow, but maybe it'll grow into a acquired steal and a late developed steal.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to stay away from the brachial artery in general. You can tell that. And I try to stay away from the brachial artery, particularly in kids.
Right. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Chris Smith, Cleveland, Ohio. We've talked a lot about you've talked a lot about the incident fistula formation. I was wondering if you could comment on the optimal monitoring program for prevalent fistulae.
The question is about monitoring, you know, and that kind of folds into monitoring and surveillance. And those are hot button issues. And I don't know, Jack's involved a lot in and recently wrote an article about the debate.
Monitoring is the physical exam of the fistula, and again, there's a number of studies that have documented its adequacy in terms of specificity and sensitivity. So monitoring really of the fistula is the ideal. Surveillance refers to using some type of device to measure flow, either duplex Doppler or transonics or some other device to actually measure the flow and from that infer access dysfunction. And that's the differentiation. I think if we do good monitoring, we don't really need the surveillance tools. I think the surveillance tools make us look at the access if we're doing that, for example, transonics surveillance. Does that address your question in terms of what's the difference between monitoring and surveillance? Or I think we shortcut our patients an awful lot, and we can educate our patients as well as our dialysis staff about monitoring. And I may have mentioned earlier, we have identified a very inexpensive stethoscope that we give our patients and teach them what to listen for in terms of their fistulas, change in the sound of the buoy. And the patient largely learns how to do their own monitoring. Certainly, it's a continuous process in terms of educating the dialysis staff in terms of doing proper monitoring on an ongoing basis. Unfortunately, it's not frequently done, but it does work when it is done.
I think surveillance, the idea is that we have a isolated, cold, hard test that's done every month. And when that isolated cold hard test gives us a number 10 instead of a number 11, that patient's shipped off to intervention and they have an angioplasty that may or may not help, may even harm, and may not be indicated.
The problem with surveillance and the tools that are currently available is that it's not a practical way of doing it frequently enough that we know that if we could do surveillance every dialysis treatment, either pressure measurements, and there are some devices and processes available, VASC Alert is one of them, that frequently does the surveillance pressure monitoring and looks at, there's wide variation, but it does sophisticated trend analysis, and that seems to have some functionality and some benefit in terms of surveillance. The trouble is it's not, it's not reimbursed. None of the surveillance techniques are reimbursed. Transonics can be done. Transonics is a very precise way to measure flow at one point in time. The trouble is that it's not reimbursed. It's done about once a month, and once a month really doesn't work well in terms of identifying. It'll identify a stenosis, but it won't identify the access that's in trouble in terms of dysfunction. So we don't have a good technique that has been well verified in randomized controlled trials for surveillance.
But when your nurse calls that the fistula has prolonged bleeding, the fistula's changed. It's now pulsatile. The fistula has high venous pressures or it has poor flow. Those are all common sense things that demand your attention, your physical examination, your ultrasound examination, and your expert decision about is an intervention warranted.
Okay. Sid Glazer, Orange. I just had three questions, if I may. First, on the use of non-penetrating clips or penetrating clips, since there have been studies on it that seem to show improved patencies.
In terms of anastomotis?
Right.
I agree with you. There are a number of published reports that indicate that. I use sutures. That's what I'm good at, and I think that individuals who take those use clips and get good results, that's an alternative that's certainly a good one. I have no experience with it personally. Do you have a tip?
No, I know Dr. Glazer uses those when you're doing end-to-end anastomoses to move things along.
Yes, my limited experience is that I like it for end-to-end, but I've had difficulty with getting good end-to-side anastomosis with it. But I use interrupted sutures at the heel and toe.
Mm-hmm.
Next is on the issue of spasm intraoperatively. You mentioned that you do completion ultrasound. I wonder, do you change your procedure? Do you make revisions on the basis of your ultrasound findings? And are you concerned about the spasm at surgery?
Well, I try very hard to be nice and to not whack the artery or the vein too much. I use a lot of solution, papaverine solution, to relax the vein as much as possible. If I complete a fistula and see some of the findings that I showed in the ultrasound with relatively high resistance in the feeding artery and a very low flow in the vein, I'm concerned. And I think something has to be done about that. If I leave the operating room in that situation, that fistula is going to clot. So I will consider reopening the anastomosis, redoing it, looking at the artery. You can use the ultrasound down in the area of the anastomosis to see if there's a stenosis there or if there is spasm visibly. Fortunately, it's not a problem that happens often, but But that can be a difficult decision-making thing. I often will reopen it and redo it.
And then regarding stents, what about for the central vein occlusion, and particularly a chronic occlusion? Will you use a bare or covered stent in that setting?
Again, if you can get across the occlusion, a complete occlusion, you almost always will need to place a stent. Again, the long-term patency of that stent is unfortunately not very good. Most of the published experiences with bare metal stents and not with the covered stents, and there are no well-done prospective studies with covered stents yet in the central circulation, unfortunately.
I think correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that in some of the locations, the central locations, need a very large balloon, and I don't think they have released yet covered stents that are 14 or 16.
There are covered stents of that size. The Viator is at that size, but again, you know, it's an off-label use. You're more likely to gel other venous return, and again, there's not any good data to support long-term good patency with the covered stent centrally.
I mean, there is some data on use of the covered stents for cephalic arch and those kind of lesions, but not central veins.
Right. And again, the outcomes, unfortunately, are not very durable.
I have a question concerning the timing on creation of long-term access. I think the guidelines that we've been following are a creatinine of 4.0 or greater, or a GFR of 15 or less. And I've noticed when I do that, a lot of patients with that kind of creatinine of 4.0, 4.2 are still not on dialysis 7 to 12 months later, or sometimes longer. And it's my impression, I don't have numbers to support this, but it seems that the fistulas that I create, if they're 4.0, seem to have a higher rate of failure. I'm not sure I've seen that in the literature written up anywhere, but that seems to be my impression. I wonder, are we still following that guideline of 4.0?
Well, there is no good data, and the original K-Doki suggested at least placing the fistula at least 6 months before anticipation of need to start dialysis. That was reduced to the rewrite, but there are no good data to suggest when is the optimal time. Too late, and then we end up starting out with a catheter too early, and we may not get a functional working fistula. You're raising the question, is the uremic environment important in terms of creating good functioning fistulas? And again, the data, we just don't know when the optimal time, and we certainly don't know how to individualize that data yet.
Could you please elaborate on the placement of the button? When is the optimal time to put them in? Could you do them during the initial procedure and just mark them for the dialysis nurses, or it has to be a period of time before the fistula has matured? And do you put one or two buttons?
Well, I think you used the word button. Buttonhole. Buttonhole is no device. Buttonhole is same-site cannulation where you eventually move to a dull needle. You may be confusing buttonhole technique, which is common and done in the dialysis unit, with that other device. Was the name of the other device?
It's a venous window needle guide, and basically that's still under it's investigational. It's been used in New Zealand and about 10 or 20 patients very successfully. Trials probably will start in this country sometime next year. It has a lot of promise, but again, until you get it out there and see, we don't know if it's going to be a useful adjunct for the deep fistula or not. The buttonhole technique, again, once a fistula is determined it's mature, ready to go, I think the important thing is that you have the best cannulator available, cannulating that needle, starting out with a smaller gauge needle, not the larger gauge needle, either a 16 or 17, and then advancing. And once you get your buttonhole tract established. Usually it's 6 to 9 cannulation times. Then you can go over to the non-cutting buttonhole needle. And basically it's identical to the regular needle, except it's dull. It doesn't cut tissue. And the patient will tell you that it's painful if you're off outside of that scar tract. You just readjust the needle until it slips in to the vein. Oh, okay. Again, that's an investigational device.
Very good talks, by the way. I think the initiative should be kind of renamed from what I've heard lately. It seems like it should be catheter last, fistula first. And, recently we had a Network 8 meeting, sat down with a lot of our nephrology colleagues. And the push seems to be so much against catheters nowadays that I get a lot of requests from my nephrology colleagues. You know, this guy needs to dialyze pretty quickly. I don't think we have time for a fistula. Why don't you go ahead and put a Gore-Tex in so we can avoid the catheter? And I'll look at some, enormous-sized veins that should make excellent fistulas, but they said, yeah, we just don't have time. We need to go ahead and get a Gore-Tex in so we can dialyze without that catheter. How are you handling those type of situations? I guess the other corollary to that is in your secondary AV fistulas, patient already dialyzing with a Gore-Tex in place, and you're considering a secondary AV fistula in that arm. What about a catheter in that patient when they go from the Gore-Tex to the fistula that you're now waiting to mature?
I think the secondary case is it really depends what your outflow vein is. If the outflow vein is a cephalic vein, oftentimes you can swing that over, and if the vein is mature, it can be used right away. And you can even test that out by having the center facility do dialysis through the cephalic vein rather than the graft while it's all still powered up and everybody can feel comfortable with it. You can swing that thing over and start cannulating it right away. Basilic vein, probably in most cases you're going to have to transpose that, and so there will be probably some catheter time with that. I think in terms of the first problem, which is a knotty problem, we all have to work together as a team. Our nephrologists and surgeons have to be on the same page. My own view about that is I think you have to have the long view. And some people are going to have a catheter for a little longer to get a fistula. A little longer, not a lot longer. I think they get into problems when we create a fistula with a marginal vein or a bad inflow, and we play with it, and then we play with it again, and then, let's give it a little more time, and the months are going by. We create a fistula, and we can reliably use that fistula in 6 to 8 weeks. I think anybody's willing to go with that. The centers get a lot of pressure based on the pattern of patients' dialysis, and so the nephrologists are under a lot of pressure. You might want to address that, Jack, but I think you have to develop that personal relationship with the guys and be able to produce reliably a functional fistula in a reasonable period of time. If you've got a good vein, you should be able to do that, and I think if you reason with the guys, you'll get there.
Can I comment on that? As a nephrologist that works with the kidney commission, you can tell that nephrologist I'm going to put a catheter after a fistula because the government is going to bear it down. Medicare, basically, reimbursement is going to depend on whether you have fistulas or not. I'm shocked to hear that nephrologist basically is telling you that they're working. I'm really, really shocked to hear he has an access for a fistula. Because the government is going to come after nephrologists and vascular surgeons who basically decide to just put in Gore-Tex clamps.
Interestingly, at that same meeting when we sat down, the question was, in our network, they said 80% of patients are initiating dialysis with catheters.
That's nationwide.
They kind of turned around to us and said, why are you guys putting in so many catheters? And I turned around and I said, I put in exactly what you ask for. And anytime you ask for a catheter, that's what you get. So if you don't want them, don't ask for them. And they thought there was some delay in from the time they got to us actually getting to surgery, or was there some concern with reimbursement, or were we having trouble getting them scheduled? I said, no, that's... We get them scheduled. We're just getting them very, very late to have their access placed. Separate question for you. As far as pre-op evaluation, Allen's test to the hand, what exactly are you doing? Are you doing PPGs on the fingertips, looking for reversal in the radial artery with proximal compression? I've been very disappointed on the reliability of what I actually see with Duplex as far as trying to predict whether I can use that radial artery or not.
I like to do the digital PPGs. I don't know, Tip, do you have a preference?
What do you look for with your PPG? A certain reduction that's acceptable?
Yeah,
not acceptable?
About 50%.
I just do a clinical exam and make sure that I can tell that the palmar arch is intact. You know, if you start off by seeing a patient mm-hmm. that doesn't have pulses at the wrist, you're making a clinical decision whether you're going to push forward with a fistula or a proximalization or some other variation of that. So I make it on clinical grounds.
In an obese patient with a nice cephalic vein, but it's too deep, do you two-stage those? Do you superficialize it, or is transposition better? And if you superficialize it, do you usually have enough length on the second stage to bring it up, or do you have to detach it and make it more proximal? Are there any tricks to that?
I generally do two-stage procedures, but I now use almost always a lipectomy procedure. Those are common veins to still be present in a patient because they can't have a needle stuck because they're that deep. If you elevate the vein, whether it's a translocation, transposition, or superficialization, you're giving up a big distance to get to the skin level from the vein, to get from to the skin level from the artery, and you're already giving up a long cannulation segment. So it's a kind of a, not a pretty, it's not a terrible hard operation, but it's a functional operation to remove the subcutaneous tissue. And I showed several slides of that, so that's what I do now.
But later on, as a second stage, after...
That's the second stage. The first stage is just to create the fistula. Then the vein gets as big as your thumb. It's 8, 10 millimeters in diameter. And then I think I can manipulate it and do the lipectomy.
Can you take too much off the skin? I mean, you don't want to make the skin...
Well, that's kind of like making the skin flat for a mastectomy.
Yeah.
You know, you leave a little bit of subcutaneous tissue, maybe 3-4 millimeters of subcutaneous tissue under there. You make several little short incisions so you don't revitalize all that skin. I have not yet had a disaster I've heard of somebody that did. Not a disaster, but an area, a little segment got necrotic. I haven't had that, and I guess I've done 60 or 70 of those so far.
What do you let them access?
It depends. I've had a couple of patients that got a hematoma under there, and it took a couple of months for that to go away. Just generally, I'll let them stick it after four weeks. But that's clinically looking at it, making sure it's soft and the tissue's healthy, and vein's okay.
In the bidirectional fistulas that you create, do you tell the dialysis nurses anything special in terms of accessing these?
Yes. I do. I have a... I think I used this phrase before, the machine doesn't care as long as they get adequate flow. So I do tell the nurses, and of course, you know, I deal with all these units over and over, so it doesn't become a much of a problem anymore. But once I pick out which segment has matured and is the cannulation site, and it could be one needle above and one needle below, do you remember seeing some pictures where I drew an arrow? So that's how the nurses get the patient when it's time to start cannulation. They get a magic marker on the arm outlining the vein and an arrow showing the blood flow. And the nurses are able to cannulate those veins, in my experience. So I do give them information, absolutely. And whether it's a bidirectional or a single vein outflow, I mark the vein when it's time to start sticking it.
I have a question regarding you're evaluating a patient for new dialysis access, and you find out they have a pacemaker or an ICD in place. First of all, do you automatically get venograms on them? And then secondly, if they have a total occlusion of the central vein, do you automatically go to the other arm, or how do you go about evaluating and decide on what to do?
I usually make the fistula. And don't think too much about it. And again, using, as Tip pointed out, try to create, a more distal inflow. So you do a radial artery that will have a moderate flow kind of fistula. I think you're unlikely to get into a critical problem. You might, but you're unlikely to. The other alternative would be to evaluate those stenoses with venography. The problem I have with that is that until you power up that venous system with your fistula, you're really not going to be able to tell from those still images unless you have a vein occlusion whether the narrowing is going to be physiologically important or not. So I don't know that the fistula, that a venogram is helpful in all cases. So I tend to construct a fistula that would be a relatively lower flow type fistula and see what happens, informing the patient that there might be an issue with it.
If you know that they have a central vein occlusion?
The circumstances of the central vein occlusion are really important. So a central vein occlusion that is in an arm that maybe had an access before and a central venous catheter versus a cardiac patient like you're talking about, many of those patients have excellent collateralization, and I think Jack talked about that a little bit. And as long as there is a network of collaterals that get into the central veins, so the azygos system via the jugular or the intercostal veins, if there's a pre-existing system like that, you can put a moderate flow fistula in that arm and have manageable edema. The only thing about it is that you can't really tell if you're how big a problem you're going to have until you do it. And so, again, you've got to have a rapport with your nephrologist and with your patient to tell them, you know, we're going to try this. It's an upper arm access. This is going to be a good thing for you if it works, but you may have a problem. We may have to reoperate and do something to help it out. Do you agree with that?
I agree with everything you said. If I have exactly the same kind of vessels situation in both arms and I have a pacemaker on one side, why not elect to go to the other side? If you have clinical evidence of central venous occlusion, pardon me, and then I also will be willing to construct the fistula. I think it was great. He said, Dr. Lilly said that tell the patient they may need a procedure. It's uncommon that you end up having to sacrifice a fistula. Usually you'll get by with that. Lots of times they won't have any swelling. And my interventional colleague can get a little guide wire through there and do an angioplasty, even along the course of a pacemaker wire. I don't know if you guys do that very much, but we certainly do.
The caveat is when the pacemaker was placed, if it's been in over 3 months, you can go ahead and safely angioplasty. If it's in less than 3 months, the wires may not be fully encased, and you may, by your angioplasty, dislodge one of the pacer wires, and if the patient is dependent on that device, you'll have problems, obviously. So, again, kind of a rule of thumb, 3 months or more. The other caveat is, unfortunately, the angioplasty corrects the problem, but it tends to come back, and it's not a long-term good outcome.
Thank you.
Maybe a final question. A patient with a phenomenal fistula complains of terrible pain every time he's accessed. We've ruled out the central venous stenosis. The nephrologist begs us to do something on the other side. The only option, of course, is a graft. The graft occludes, central line, etc. We've abandoned a perfectly fistula under both patient and nephrology pressure. So I guess my question is, what do you do with the patient where there is significant discomfort every time they're accessed? What are we dealing with? What's the etiology? Oftentimes we'll look for a central stenosis. If that's absent, I'm oftentimes at a loss to provide any help to that patient.
I think it's the question, everybody probably heard that. The question is pain during dialysis. I think it's critical to get more information. Is your pain in your hand? Is your pain where they cannulate it? Is your pain at the end of dialysis? Is your pain the minute they stick the needle in? Is the pain in your shoulder? Are you having a headache? And it's an endless number of things you need to sort through. If they're having pain in their hand, maybe they do have some ischemic function. Maybe they have carpal tunnel, and so you need to go do a careful exam and rule out some kind of single nerve complaint that might be like a carpal tunnel syndrome. If they're having ischemic changes in their hand, they need to have a workup for that. 15-20% of those people have an inflow issue that can be cured with an angioplasty. They need an arteriogram, and then you get a kind of gestalt feel. Do they have a steal or not have a steal? If they don't have a pulse at their wrist and you occlude their fistula and a bounding pulse returns at their wrist,
that may well be ischemic discomfort in their hand that's moderate instead of a dead finger, and you can deal with that if it's a high-flow fistula by a pretty simple banding procedure that we've already talked about. So I think you have to sort through what's the... You know, if you talk to them enough, maybe they'll say it's when nurse... when James, the nurse, the way he cannulates my fistula, it hurts. So I think you get a lot of information if you just put some time. And you know, maybe there's no ischemia in their hand and you can turn their flow down the last hour of dialysis to 300 instead of 800 because that's what their the company says they have to. There's a lot of ways to skin that cat. And, you know, maybe they have a profound ischemia and you need to get after it right now.
Deborah Boyd, North Carolina, general vascular surgeon. Realistically, how late can you wait before you do a declot on a radiocephalic AV fistula? I seem to not know about it the first day. Maybe they tell me about it a week later.
Okay.
Do you want to...
Well, I think...
Well, that certainly has never happened to me.
No, me
it
either.
Must be in your part of the country.
It has to be.
I think that's one of the exciting things about fistulas, in that not that many years ago, the dogma was that if a fistula thrombosis, hey, it's over with, go put something else in. But over the years, it really the last 5 to 6 years, it's really been well documented that if you intervene early, the earlier the better, from the standpoint you avoid a catheter if that patient's been a week without dialysis, something else is going on. But the earlier you intervene, your success rate for successfully declotting that fistula is almost the same as with a graft. It's certainly 80-90% of the time you're going to be successful. And it typically is an inflow problem. Depending on if it's a radiocephalic fistula. But the earlier the better. If they're waiting a week, what in the world have they been doing?
Well, oftentimes it's patients that are preparing for dialysis.
Well, now that's another, another little kind of a thing because you might need to...
If it's not that, it's 3 days because they clotted Saturday and they're arriving Tuesday.
3 days, go for it because your success rate is going to be very high. Your success rate does go down with time. You know, the longer it's been thrombosed, that thrombus organizes and it becomes like a cord-like, like a deep vein thrombophlebitis. But again, been successful a week, 2 weeks out. You earlier the better, though.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think it depends how long your fistula has been in place. If you're talking about the pre-dialysis patient or the fistula you've constructed and you discover post-operatively, post-op day 5, they call you up and say it's not buzzing, and it hasn't buzzed since they left the hospital. That vein segment that's clotted, you're not going to be able to get that going, I don't think. But a fistula that's been in place and running for any period of time, you've got time to either do a chemical or a mechanical thrombectomy.
And what would you normally choose if you had the option?
A lot of interventionalists will choose both, but I'd certainly try interventional technique, and we'll try it 3 weeks after a clotted fistula, yeah. Most of them are cleared, as Dr. Lilly said, if the fistula was already an established fistula. And they have several new tools, thrombectomy devices, they have little balloon catheters they can remove clot. They have a lot of tricks that allow them to get those fistulas open. And one of those might be lytic therapy that they'd use or not use.
Or a combination of those.
A combination.
And again, the other end of the spectrum is that large, tortuous brachiocephalic fistula that looks like a snake that is as big as your wrist, that is full of clot all the way back up to the cephalic arch. You've got aneurysms on it and so forth. You got to ask the question in that setting: is it worth saving, and should you do something else? So, again, you have to individualize the therapy, but a fistula that's been functioning as thrombosed, the likelihood of getting it open using the endovascular techniques is very, very high.
Thank you.